President Stoddard, and ladies and gentlemen, I see that President Stoddard, though he's no longer an ordinary professor, but has long since become a university administrator, is still enough of an academic to go through the records and dig up stuff. And even embarrassing stuff. Though I'm glad that he mentioned this round table because I might possibly, before I forget in the evening, have something more to say about Mr. Brock Chisholm and his way of dealing with world affairs. Our topic this evening is the social and the spiritual dimension of the world crisis. One could also define it as the crisis in our culture and the crisis in our civilization if one adapted Spengler's definition of the difference, and I wouldn't follow Spengler any further than that. When Spengler says that culture is the spirit of a civilization and civilization is the body of a culture, I think that is a possible distinction, and one would mean by civilization the way we organize our life, our economic, political, and social arrangements, and one would mean by culture our art, our philosophy, and our religion, realm in which we interpret the very meaning of our existence. Now, I think it is obvious that in any great crisis of the world, any really great crisis, both the culture and the civilization are challenged, though we can have minor crises in which only the civilization is challenged, is shaken, is rearranged. But if it is a significant crisis, questions are asked not only about how we should organize our life, but questions are asked whether we have rightly interpreted the very meaning of our existence. Thus, for instance, when the Roman Empire fell, it wasn't only Rome, the Pax Romana, as a political system which was challenged and destroyed, but also the Greco-Roman culture with its conception of a cyclical history, with its endless recurrences and the meaning of life being found in the emancipation of human reason from the contingencies and recurrences of history. This whole system of thought, which gave meaning to the classical world, was challenged and was destroyed, and out of it emerged the Christian faith as the basis of the spiritual life of the Western world. There was another great crisis in our Western history when modern commercial society, modern economic society, challenged the static agrarian feudal society and changed it. But were also the Reformation and the Renaissance deeply shook the medieval Catholic conception of life, which had informed the spirit of men up until that time. I do not say that it destroyed Catholicism, which remains a powerful force in our contemporary life, but it is no longer the dominant force of our modern culture. There arose out of this destruction of the medieval world, an agrarian world in economics, a feudal aristocratic world in politics, a Catholic world in culture and religion. There arose out of this decay, what we now regard as our modern civilization and our modern culture. As civilization, a vast commercial society, an industrial one. As culture, having curious combinations of Renaissance and Christian Reformation and also classical humanism in it. It is this particular culture, as well as our civilization, which is quite obviously in a crisis, for we are not sure whether we can survive as a civilization in our generation. We've had two great world wars, and I'm not certain that we can avoid the third. This is quite obviously a crisis of very vast proportions. We don't like really to think how vast it is. One of the interesting things when men live in great crises is that there are some who historically overestimate the depth and the breadth of it, but most of us are inclined rather to underestimate it, for it is a rather dizzy experience to watch walk at the edge of an abyss. So we turn our eyes from the depth of the abyss. But it is a deep crisis, and perhaps the simplest way of defining the social dimension of this crisis in which we stand is to say, we have the problem, and we have not yet solved the problem, of establishing community within terms set by techniques. This is what gives our culture and civilization's particular color. A vast expansion of techniques. Not that techniques have not been expanding since the very beginning of human culture, with the domestication of animals, with the discovery of seed time and harvest, with the invention of the plow, the invention of the wheel, the invention of the water wheel. All these things took ages, however. And we have moved into from coal to electricity, and from electricity to atomic energy, all inside of a little more than a century. The vast expansion of techniques is what has challenged us, and has challenged us in terms of the problems of justice and community. Can we maintain, preserve, and extend community within this dimension of set by techniques? It isn't merely that modern techniques have created a potential world community, but not an actual one. This is one dimension of the crisis. The modern techniques have related the nations to each other in terms of economic interdependence, but have not automatically created sufficient community to make this interdependence sufferable. That's one level of our social crisis. But it isn't only that. It's also true that modern techniques tend to destroy the old, primordial, organic forms of community, the most primordial of all being the family. I regard it as a rather tragic fact that an age which faces the possibility of atomic destruction on the ultimate level of community also faces the destruction of the family, at least its serious disintegration, on the most primordial level of community. Which raises all kinds of questions, whether it may be that this family, which has been the seed pot of the human community through all the ages, may have been held together to a certain degree by agrarian circumstances and is no longer held together now by anything except just the moral forces within the family itself, which have not been sufficient to hold it together. We're living in a period of a disintegrating family. And there is another level. Above the level of the primordial community, let us say the national community, in which modern techniques have substituted dynamic centers of power for the old static centers of power in an agrarian society, and we have not yet learned how to achieve justice within terms of these new centralizations of power and shifts of power, rapid shifts of power which go on in a technical society. So we face a great deal of confusion on every one of these levels. It's an interesting thing how culture and civilization interplay, however, because if we had only had to deal with a problem of establishing community in terms of techniques, an international community, for instance, and justice in the national community, we might have tolerably succeeded. As a matter of fact, the healthiest nations, like the healthier European nations and our own, have not done so badly in adjusting their communal life and establishing a tolerable justice in a technical civilization. But there entered a certain cultural element into this that created a civil war at the very heart of our civilization, and the civil war became internationalized because it was nationally localized between ourselves, let us say, and Russia. Let me say just a word about this civil war. You could say that the middle classes who rose to power against the agrarian aristocracy of the medieval period and who dominate, or have dominated, this so-called civilization, modern civilization of ours, these middle classes had a rather curious creed, principle for organizing their social life. which if they had followed it consistently, they would have had no social life at all. For the basic creed, though it was not the only one, and I'm going to be a little sketchy, but certainly one of the basic creeds of middle-class life was that when you face the vast intricacies of man's social existence, you don't have to worry too much about it because it'll take care of itself. There is an automatic harmony in life. History is like nature. There's a pre-established harmony in nature. Is there not a pre-established harmony in nature, said these philosophers of the 18th and 19th century, and was finally incorporated in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations? Is there not a pre-established harmony of nature, and is there not a pre-established harmony of history? Well, there isn't, of course. This is the difference between man and nature and history and nature, that man breaks all the harmony of nature and either creates wider harmonies or wider disharmonies. It's the very character of human history. From the beginning, from the most primitive time to our advanced civilization, this is what historical action is like, so that there is no community that is not contrived. I think that Arnold Toynbee is right in suggesting that each time a human community breaks down, and if there is enough imagination to reconstruct it, it will be reconstructed on a higher level away from nature than a previous community. Thus, a modern capitalistic industrial society is not as close to nature as an agrarian society. It has all kinds of dynamic forces in it which have to be managed, or they will destroy us. There is no such thing as a pre-established harmony of nature. And there are a few people, of course, now who believe that there is, except a few politicians in America. But this, on the whole, was the essential creed of middle-class life. There's a particular irony about it, by the way, that the physiocrats should have introduced that doctrine into the stream of history at the precise moment when an agrarian society was becoming a technical one. For in an agrarian society, there is no perfect harmony, but there is a static disharmony. And a technical society changes the static disharmony into a dynamic one. So there is no harmony there at all. Some time ago, I was giving a lecture at the University of Glasgow, and the principal of the university took me to a building where there were two memorial plaques, which he thought were significant, and I thought so too. One of them was to Adam Smith, and the other one was to Watt, the inventor of the steam engine, who were classmates at Glasgow University. What was significant about this is that the steam engine of Watt made nonsense out of the doctrine of Adam Smith. Now, the tragic thing in our civilization was that whatever was wrong in this doctrine, and it isn't altogether wrong, by the way, because it's a very important thing for a technical society to have as many automatic processes in its life as possible, simply because we're not wise enough to make conscious choices all the time. And if there are any kind of automatic balances there, we ought to preserve them, and if they have become disbalanced, we ought to try to establish them again. This isn't altogether wrong. None of these doctrines are altogether wrong. We have been almost driven to distraction by half-truths, being thrown against half-truths in the situation. At any rate, the half-truth here was countered by the great Marxist rebellion against middle-class life, which became the religion of the industrial workers of Europe. One of the reasons why we're healthy is because this particular rebellion never took this violent religious form in our country that it did in Europe. It destroyed Germany. It is still destroying France. It makes the question whether France can be, for instance, a dependable ally in the free world. This was an awful civil war. And the two proponents had, on the one hand, the doctrine of history being a simple harmony and moving to a higher and higher harmony, and the other had the doctrine that history was a conflict, an awful conflict, which would finally issue in a definitive and final and climactic civil war out of which a new society would emerge. How?